Right to resist, right to exist, unite to fight police terror, state repression, and racism. Organized by the ILPS USA to mark the two-year anniversary of Laquan McDonald's murder by a Chicago police officer. The Converse focuses on the ongoing people struggle in Chicago against state repression, national oppression, and neoliberal attacks on the people. In holding this conference, the ILPS USA aims to gather grassroots activists, allies, and concerned peoples to dialogue, share strategies, and raise the national discourse around police brutality, racism, and politically motivated repression to link these issues to the impacts of its U.S. foreign policy, its wars of aggression, and military intervention abroad.
Chicago has a long history of working class militancy with the 1886 Haymarket labor demonstration and the ensuing massacre and state executions now recognized by the world as the origins of International Workers' Day. The city was also a major center of the early 1960s civil rights movement and the 1968 anti-war protests all the way to the 1970s. Its activist organizations kept the fires of people's resistance burning throughout the neoliberal era until now. Advanced industrialized nations, such as the U.S. and Canada, continue to reel from the crisis of neoliberalism that rose to prominence since the 2007-2008 financial meltdown and the ensuing Great Recession. The rapid growth of privatization of public resources, financialization, liberalization, deregulation, and imperialist globalization from the late 1970s onwards, instead of perfecting monopoly capitalism, are instead aggravating all of its contradictions. The result is worsening underdevelopment of most countries, the spread of poverty and social inequalities. With the labor market deregulated since the 1980s, the exploitation of the U.S. working class has become most flagrant at the lowest rungs of the labor ladder, where most women, youth, blacks, and immigrants find themselves.
The federal government boasts that U.S. jobs grew from 2011 to 2016. However, it has taken longer and longer for job growth rates to recover from one recession to the next. Also, the net job creation in the last 10 years is in alternative work arrangements, such as contract, temporary help, on-call, independent contractors, or freelancers, which generally pay lower wages and do not include health and pension benefits. The low unemployment rate at 5% as of November 2015 merely hides the fact that the growing number of workers, mainly Black and Latino, who are discouraged from looking for work or who are no longer counted as part of the labor force. The youth unemployment rate is much higher at 15.7%. The ratio of unionized and salary workers in the U.S. declined from 24% in 1973 to 11.1% in 2015. As a result, by 2015, the median weekly earnings of non-union full-time wage and salary workers were generally lower by $200 compared to their union counterparts. Even among unionized workers, the median weekly earnings of women stood at $928, lower than that of men at $1,017. The earnings of Black and both men and women stood even lower at $800. The number of officially poor in the U.S. has increased from 38 million in 2007 to 48.81 million in 2013, with current poverty rates hovering just below 16%. At the same time, income inequalities have worsened. The highest 20% of U.S. households controlled 43.3% of the total wealth in 1970. It increased to 49.8% in 2000 and 51.1% by 2015. In comparison, the lowest 80% earned only 4.1% in 1970, 3.6% in 2000, and 3.1% in 2015.
Social inequalities are also evident in residential segregation, which has gotten worse from decade to decade. The U.S. federal government claims that it has pushed down the overall rate of homelessness, but the housing crisis remains a big problem. The number of poor renter households with severe housing cost burden increased from 5.13 million in 2007 to 6.42 million in 2013, while the number of poor people who are doubling up with family and friends jumped from 4.61 million to 7.69 million in the same period. High school dropout rates have risen and college enrollment rates have fallen across all categories, but are especially worse among Blacks and Latinos. Such worsening exploitation, poverty, inequalities, and homelessness forms the backdrop of worsening state repression, police terrorism, and fascist impunity, which in turn are making the face of neoliberalism more loathsome to the masses. The systematic deprivation of social resources, especially to working class, Black and immigrant communities, lead to the proliferation of ghetto-like conditions in many U.S. cities. Police forces automatically assume criminal intent when they see any gesture of resistance in neighborhoods and on the streets. Criminalization of all kinds of citizen behavior, militarization of police equipment and procedure, and lack of strict accountability are resulting in extreme police actions such as raids on homes, routine stop and frisk, physical abuse of suspects, and arbitrary shootings resulting in injuries, deaths, and cover-ups. According to a study by The Guardian, U.S. law enforcement officers killed a total of 1,134 Americans in 2015. Non-white Americans, Black, Latino, Native, and Asia Pacific make up less than 38% of the U.S. population, yet they comprise almost half, 47.2% of all people, and more than half, 53.6% of all unarmed people killed by police. The situation is worse among young Black men. Despite making up only 2% of the total U.S. population, Black males between 15 and 34 comprised more than 15% of all police killings. Of all Black people killed by U.S. police in 2015, nearly 70% were nonviolent or unarmed. The U.S. incarceration rate has grown dramatically since the 1970s and is now one of the highest rates in the world. Based on a 2008 study among young Black males who are high school dropouts, a full 37% are in prison or jail.
The current U.S. presidential campaign, foreign policy debacles, and military adventures abroad further underscore the gravity and irreconcilability of the basic contradictions of monopoly capitalism, which have been aggravated by the current crisis of neoliberalism. On the one hand, the imperialists are using the presidential campaign and narrow defined election issues to divide the U.S. working people, working class and oppressed peoples, agitate them to fight each other, and gloss over the fundamental issues of monopoly capitalist exploitation and oppression, which drive police terror, state repression, and racism. In the whole range of domestic and global issues are handled correctly, however, they can teach the U.S. working people, including women, youth, Black, immigrant, and the homeless, and impoverished veterans, to understand in a deep-going way how domestic issues are tightly intertwined with global issues. That all these issues revolve around the dominance and decadence of U.S. imperialism underscores the urgent need for the U.S. working people to build an anti-imperialist united front in the very belly of the beast and direct their struggles against this monster. We must transcend the neoliberal, neoconservative, and neo-fascist attacks by forging unity. We must more strongly than ever assert the people's right to fight monopoly capitalist exploitation and state repression.
The International League of People's Struggle represents what is currently the largest anti-imperialist formation in terms of membership. It is offering to contribute to the effort to build such a united front in the U.S. itself. The U.S. chapter of the ILPS, established in 2012, is ready to reach out to all interested organizations representing various sectors of the American people. This conference, the first major activity of ILPS U.S. since 2012, seeks for such a united front to achieve solidarity, strength, and greater successes through mass struggles in these times of worsening social crisis, severe state terrorism, and intensifying struggles. The periodic political contests between two or more factions of the monopoly big bourgeoisie, even if they appear to address some of the people's real issues, will never bring about fundamental social changes. The working people of the U.S. must continue to organize, mobilize, and rely on themselves to create this change. Long live international solidarity!
Thank you. The image of a young woman, her hair wrapped in a red keffiyeh, clutching an AK-47, became a symbol of Palestinian resistance across the world. After Leila Khaled hijacked a TWA flight from Athens, bound for Athens from Rome on August 29, 1969. Just over a year and six plastic surgeries later, she was arrested during a second hijacking attempt during which one of her comrades was shot dead. Khaled's main aim was to bring to the world's attention the Palestinian people's struggle. She said, "Before the hijackings, no one heard our screaming from the tents." The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine is still the biggest leftist organization in Palestinian political life. Leila Khaled remains one of the PFLP's most recognizable figures and a global icon of resistance. After serving as keynote speaker for the 5th International Assembly of ILPS in November of 2015, Leila Khaled accepted the invitation to become an honorary member of the League. I would like to call Fatin Jarara of Palestinian Youth Movement to read Leila's message to this conference.
It's an honor to be here amongst all of you, and it's an extreme honor for me to read this statement on behalf of my sister and comrade, Leila Khaled, who I had the pleasure of meeting last year in the Philippines at the ILPS conference, and it was an amazing experience. And I want to read this as a Palestinian young woman living in the diaspora. On behalf of my party, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and the liberation struggle of the Palestinian people, I greet and salute you today. The International League of People's Struggle plays a distinguished and critical role in building international resistance to imperialism, which ravages our homelands and requires the construction of a front of resistance among our struggles for justice and liberation. I had the great honor of addressing the 5th International Assembly of ILPS and serving as an honorary member of ILPS. When in Manila, it was a powerful and remarkable experience to meet with the movements in the Philippines struggling on the front lines to combat imperialism, feudalism, and bureaucrat capitalism, from the women's movements to workers and peasants organizing, to the powerful meeting that I had with the LUMAD, the indigenous people struggling for the return of their land from which they were uprooted. As our Palestinian people have been struggling to return to our occupied and colonized homeland for nearly 70 years, as an indigenous people forced from our homes by Zionist settler colonial armies, we felt a commonality and mutual understanding of our struggles as indigenous peoples. Today, we know that you are meeting in the belly of the beast of U.S. imperialism as it bombs and threatens to bomb and rain death and destruction on people around the world. It is critical for the movements in the United States to build and develop your ongoing work and struggle to confront imperialism and the threat it poses to the world, to stop its ongoing threats and reality of raining bombs and drone warfare on the people of Syria and Yemen, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. Its policy of destruction that continues to threaten to push back progressive and revolutionary movements in Latin America, and its policy of strategic alliance and funding for settler colonialism abroad of $38 billion to the Zionist occupation state for the weaponry used to suppress, subjugate, and dispossess the Palestinian people. The building of an anti-war, anti-imperialist movement is absolutely critical to confront the U.S. war machine, particularly inside the United States with a strong internationalist focus. ILPS is playing an important role in making this a reality. Of course, we also see the realities of the United States beyond its power and threat as not only an imperial aggressor against our peoples and homelands, but also as a settler colonial enterprise built on the genocide of indigenous people and the enslavement and oppression of black people and other oppressed peoples. We extend our strongest support for the black liberation movement, for the indigenous movement struggling in Standing Rock and across the land, and for all the struggles and popular movements fighting hard inside the imperial monster itself. On this occasion, we also salute the people of the Philippines for your victory in pushing out U.S. joint military exercises. A powerful victory in well over 120 years of struggle against U.S. imperialism. At the same time, we see the police trucks seeking to mow down the protesters of the National Democratic Movements, taking the streets at the U.S. Embassy, and we express all of our solidarity to the people of the Philippines and your popular movements in the confrontation of U.S. imperialism and its allies at home and in winning justice for your people. We also note on this occasion that this week and on October 24th, mark the 33rd anniversary of the imprisonment of George Ibrahim Abdullah, the Lebanese communist revolutionary struggle for Palestine. He has been in prison since October 24, 1984. And as we speak, people are protesting around the world, including outside of his prison, for his freedom. George Abdullah, like the Palestinians prosecuted in the United States, like the legendary Rasmiya Odeh, for decades, a symbol of struggle for Palestinian women and the entire Palestinian people, is part of struggle of over 7,000 Palestinians for liberation from Zionist and imperialist jails and persecution. Today, it is critical to build international support for George Abdullah, for Rasmiya Odeh, and for all of the Palestinian political prisoners, including the leader of our party, Ahmed Saadat, imprisoned in Zionist prisons. We know that our leaders are tortured, imprisoned, held behind bars in order to isolate their vision and hold the struggle of the Palestinian people for freedom, for the liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea, and for the return of Palestinian refugees in our millions, and for the dismantling of the entire Zionist project that has been constructed upon our dispossession. And this is why we emphasize that we must not rest until every Palestinian prisoner is free. This is the road to freedom for Palestine and part of the struggle for justice and liberation everywhere in the world. We also know that it is in nearly November and nearly the anniversary of the British colonial Balfour Declaration that promised the land of Palestine to the Zionist movement. This also marks 100 years of the Palestinian people's struggle for liberation and against colonialism. On this 100-year anniversary, we must mark it not only with memory, but with action and intensified struggle. Your protests, your demonstrations, and your demands for boycott and international isolation of the Israeli state and the Zionist project are part of the struggle of the Palestinian people to achieve the right of return and the liberation of all of Palestine. We salute the work being done in the United States by so many organizations, particularly among students and youth, and urge you to escalate, intensify, and build upon the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel and in support of the Palestinian people's resistance and national liberation struggle. All salutes to the International League of People's Struggle and your anti-imperialist resistance in the center of U.S. imperialism. Victory to Palestine. Victory to all of the people's struggle for liberation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Fatin, and thank you, Layla. I'll take this opportunity to also announce that next year in November in Beirut, the ILPS will be having a conference marking the 100th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. So I would like to welcome our compañero, Jose Rodriguez Espinosa, the Consul General of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela.
Good morning. I was here, like, not here in this place, but in the previous conference, like, 4 years ago, and I was impressed on how many people you managed to gather in these events. So I'm very honored to be invited again to say a few words today, and I congratulate the work that ILPS has been doing, not only in the U.S., but all over. So I want to thank you for doing the job that you do, and I want to also highlight how many alliance ILPS has been doing, at least here in Chicago. That is the place that I know, and how well connected it is with different organizations like the Arab American Action Network, the Committee to Stop FBI Repression, the Committee Against Violence, and different groupings that live and work here in Chicago that do an incredible work. And one of the things that I like the most is that you are connected, and I believe that that's very important. But going back to my country, which is always in the news, I want to tell you that one of the reasons for Venezuela being too much in the spot since, I don't know, 6 or 8 years, is because we are an anti-imperialist country. I want to highlight that because, I mean, there's no other explanation for how well are we and how bad are we covered in the mainstream media here in the U.S. and all over the world. And the only explanation to that is because of the policies that were initiated by President Chavez during the first years of his government. So that's the biggest explanation about how, why we are like spotted in the news as the bad guys, like the violator of human rights, like the bad influence in Latin America, and all the things that you might hear around. So I just wanted to highlight that because I believe that that's very connected with the roots of what ILPS is. So Venezuela is anti-imperialist. I mean, and we have been developing that sentiment every day. That sentiment has been growing in Venezuela, especially during the presidency of President Chavez, but also with the president of President Maduro, and that's why they keep working in sabotaging the government of President Maduro and portraying us like the things that you usually hear in the media. So, and that's why, like, 1 year and a half, the U.S. government approved, President Obama passed an executive order that declared us an extraordinary security threat to the U.S. So that's somehow give you an idea of what happened in Venezuela and how the empire look after us, trying to destroy what we have been doing in Venezuela. And that executive order was renewed this year by President Obama. Even though the year before, a few months before the approval of the first one, they say that executive order didn't matter and was not going to have any effect, but it have effects. Actually, it have economic effects in Venezuela. That executive order affect the access of Venezuela to loans, for example, international loans. That executive order affect the rating of Venezuela in those agencies that work around risk, that are very connected to the financial sector, and you know how they work. But that's somehow the connection between the anti-imperialist stand of Venezuela and the most recent current events. From the aggressions from the U.S. towards Venezuela, I have to say also we are in the middle of a very deep economic crisis in Venezuela for the last 3 years. That's not a lie. That's actually a fact, and we are very, very affected by the economic, by the oil prices crisis, but also by the economic blockade that we have and financial blockade that we have. And we have been trying to solve those problems slowly, but I believe that we are reaching the the bottom of the crisis, and I hope that in the next months we might be able to start, you know, rebuilding the economy in Venezuela. But that's not easy, especially when you are being attacked all the time, not only from the U.S. by the U.S., but by all the big forces around the world. But I wanted to highlight that 70% of the budget that we just approved this year, a few weeks ago in Venezuela, is dedicated to social programs. Even though we're in the one of the worst economic crises that we have seen in decades in Venezuela. So that means that 70% of our budget is going to social security, to housing, to health, to education, to keep the people working. So I believe that that's very important to say because, I mean, we are doing the contrary of what any other country do or is imposed to do by the IMF or the World Bank in the middle of an economic crisis. And I feel very proud of that because even in this big economic crisis that we are facing, we are trying to do what we are supposed to do, I mean, to reach the problems of the majority of the people of Venezuela. And we have problems, but I believe that this is like a big expression of the of our commitment with the majority of the Venezuelans. And the last thing that I wanted to highlight is that even in the middle of this economical crisis that we are facing, we keep working in international solidarity, especially in the region, our region of influence, which is Latin America and the Caribbean. And recently, after the Matthews hurricane, we were the first country that sent planes to Haiti to help in the recovery after the hurricane. And we have been keeping sending planes with medicines, with food, with assistance to Haiti nonstop, very working hand in hand with the Cuban government, which I believe is with Venezuela. We are the two countries that are doing the most of the work trying to assist the Haitian people, not only after this hurricane, but after the 2010 earthquake. So one of the nicest things that you might feel out of this international solidarity is working around and meeting Haitian people and hearing them telling you how grateful and how much they love the Venezuelan people because of the work that we do. And that's very different from what you hear about what the U.S. solidarity do in Haiti. I wanted to highlight that. And I also wanted to highlight that in the middle of this economical crisis, we are also are receiving international students in the International School of Medicine in Venezuela, and we have Palestinian students there. We have students from Latin America. The International School of Medicine is the equivalent, Venezuelan equivalent to the Cuban International School of Medicine, and we are also providing scholarship for students from all over the world to study medicine in Venezuela. And a few weeks ago, we graduated from not only from that school but from different medicine schools in Venezuela, 5,000 medical doctors in just one day. So that's to give you an idea of what we are doing even in the midst of this economical crisis. So talking about solidarity, I just, to finish my words, want to encourage you to also try to support Venezuelan cause as much as you can because, I mean, we are aware about the importance of international solidarity. And we know that our people in Venezuela need some sort of to realize that there is some sort of solidarity towards what we have been doing there, because that give us strength, that give us hope, that give us like the energy that sometimes we don't have, especially in the middle of difficult times like the ones that we are passing right now. So that's my invitation for you to try to support us the most, if you want to do it, that's it. Thank you for letting me talk today.
Thank you so much. As you may have noticed, I'm not Berna Ellerin. I'm Rhonda Romero. I'm the Vice Chair of Buying USA, and I would also like to welcome you all here today. We're very honored to have Jesus speak with us. ILPS led a delegation to Cuba this past May, and we saw firsthand the way the Venezuelan people and the Cuban people are making it all happen. That vision that we always talk about what the world could look like and should look like, they're building it there, right in the backyard of U.S. imperialism. So thank you. So we are about to welcome up panelists for our very first panel, The Right to Exist, Right to Resist. We're here in Chicago, right? And I see a lot of people here from Chicago. And there's a reason we chose Chicago. And it's for all the reasons Berna talked about earlier. You know, it's about the resistance to imperialism that's happening right here on the streets of Chicago. You know, many of you may have noticed that, you know, this crisis of imperialism that we're talking about hits very close to home. It hits locally. It's not just something out there in the world. It hits locally. You know, we felt it in the bones of the homeless man we saw on the street of East 73rd yesterday. We saw it in the neighborhoods of foreclosed homes and the boarded up storefronts. We can hear it in the cries of the moms and the dads and the sisters and the grandmas and the brothers who have lost loved ones stolen by police violence. But not only that, we heard the cries of resistance from our sisters in CoStar this morning. It's not just about the cries of pain, it's about resistance. We feel it on the streets of Chicago when we see and we hear the shouts of protest against the murder of Laquan McDonald. And we've been feeling it and hearing it and seeing it in the halls of City Hall in Chicago as they demand that for a Civilian Police Accountability Council that's elected. So this conference isn't just about hearing about the pains and the suffering, but about feeling and hearing and seeing the resistance and actually getting together and doing something about it, right? And that's what we're here for today. So how many people in this room are named Frank Chapman? We have one. So to bring it all back and to bring out local struggles and illuminate the impacts of imperialism and the resistance that's happening, I'd like to invite Frank Chapman, our first speaker. Frank Chapman is the field organizer and educational director of the Chicago Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. Founded in 1973. At the age of 19, Frank Chapman was wrongfully convicted himself of first-degree murder and armed robbery and confined to a Missouri prison. Frank Chapman said he was beaten by police and put in an isolation cell until he confessed to the crime. And then 14 years later, he was freed with support from some of the same people who also helped to free Angela Davis. It is my honor to invite Frank Chapman to share with you this morning.
First of all, I want to really express my feeling of honor to be here today with this august group of people. We never had any doubt at any moment in our political life that the struggle against imperialism was waning or dying. We always knew that fight was there. But it's nothing like it coming out like it's coming out today. We have in the Pacific region, in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, or the Americas, we have the people coming forward and fighting against imperialism. And today we stand in solidarity with all those in Chicago and throughout the world who are commemorating and honoring the memory of Laquan McDonald and all sisters and brothers murdered, brutalized, and tortured by the Chicago Police Department. Our struggle, too, is a part of the struggle against imperialism. Today, we are honored that the International League of People's Struggle and the Chicago Alliance Against Race and Political Repression are sharing the same platform as we join together to recommit ourselves to the people's struggles against imperialism in Africa, Asia, the Americas, and the island nations of the Pacific. Today we proudly declare that we stand unequivocally united with the International League of People's Struggle in promoting, supporting, and developing the anti-imperialist and democratic struggles of the peoples of the world against imperialism and all reaction. We can say today that in one moment of history not long past, that the uprising in Ferguson revealed starkly and tragically the militarization of the police and their occupation of our communities. We have also observed that the murder of Laquan McDonald on October 20, 2014, revealed that Mayor Rahm Emanuel and the city officials of Chicago are dedicated to covering up police crimes and corruption and have abandoned altogether the pursuit of justice when it comes to black and brown people being murdered by the police. When the incriminating video of the murder of Laquan McDonald was in the process of being released, we were asked by a number of reporters from the bourgeois press if we thought releasing the video would cause an uprising. Our response was simple. If there's an uprising, then the mayor and his cohorts have to take responsibility for it. We further stated, our movement will continue to organize peaceful, nonviolent protests demanding that Officer Van Dyke be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, that Dante Servin, the cop who murdered Rekia Boyd, be fired and federally prosecuted, and that the video recording of the murder of Ronald Ronnie Man Johnson be released. We will also continue to mobilize and organize for international human rights, and we will protest and demonstrate at the federal building and all buildings representing authority in this country until we get what we want. The DOJ has been investigating the police murder of Flint Former for 5 years, and we haven't heard a whisper. They continue to stand mute on the torture of black and brown people here in Chicago. They have not closed the torture site at Holman Square that has reputedly detained and tortured thousands of people, most of them people of color. If they don't want us outraged and angry, then they need to prosecute and jail these killer cops and those cops who torture people. Let us take the righteous anger of the people and channel it into building the most powerful militant grassroots movement Chicago and this nation has ever seen, for an all-elected, all-civilian Police Accountability Council, also known as CPAC. In response to the epidemic of police crimes in this city, we have built the most powerful and organized grassroots movement for community control of the police that this nation has ever seen. This is a fact that is publicly acknowledged by members of the City Council and even a begrudging corporate-controlled mass media. We put out a call for an all-elected Civilian Police Accountability Council, CPAC, in 2012 with 150 individual supporters, a handful of community-based organizations, and a committee of 5 or 6 people. Today, our Stop Police Crimes Organizing Committee has over 100 signed up members and over 30 people who regularly attend meetings. Movements are not only measured by the number of heads it can count or the organizational support it gets from people. In the final analysis, movements such as ours must also be measured by its ability to challenge the powers that be and bring about systemic changes needed to empower the people. To be blunt, we must ask ourselves the questions: what are we doing to change the power relationships between the oppressor and the oppressed? How are we consciously engaging the masses of our people in the struggle for justice, peace, and democracy? And for this crowd, I would add socialism. Our Chicago Alliance is implementing a full-blown, block-by-block field operation that organizes people at the grassroots level to introduce to some and further educate others on CPAC and an action plan for its implementation in the city of Chicago. The CPAC ordinance is currently in the City Council chamber and is championed by 9 City Council members. 17 additional council members are needed to assure the support of a majority of the City Council chamber. No professional lobbyist service is proposed. Instead, all our resources will be devoted to further educate those who live in Chicago communities hardest hit by police misconduct and crimes. We will conduct workshops on the history of campaigns calling for community control of the police, on how CPAC differs from the current problematic structure of mayor-appointed police oversight, and provide community organizing training to residents. Presently, several hundred Chicago-based volunteers have already pledged to devote time and effort to the CPAC initiative. We will work to activate these volunteers in each of their neighborhoods. When the CPAC ordinance is enacted, it will essentially have the same powers that are currently held by the mayor, the police board, and the civilian office of police accountability, except CPAC will be elected, not appointed. Okay, this is a democratic solution, as opposed to the various bureaucratic solutions that are currently being proposed or currently being put on the table by various groups, but particularly by the mayor of this city. Ours is the only proposal that calls for an all-elected civilian police accountability council that calls for the enforcement of the democratic right of the people to control the policing of their communities. I want to close by acknowledging, well, I don't see it now, it's somebody, our right to exist, our right to resist.
It's still there.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's an old civil rights song. It goes like this here. I'm not going to sing it all. But it says, the first thing I did right was when I started to fight. Keep your eye on the prize. Hold on. Okay. The first thing I did right was when I started to fight. Keep your eye on the prize. Hold on. All right. So it's about the fight. It's about the fight. See, we have an inalienable democratic right and duty to fight. And we can never allow the oppressor to take that away from us. See, we stand on that. No matter what's going on, we don't never say we can't hold the ruling class accountable. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. And it's our duty to do that. Okay? All power to the people.
All power to the people.
Thank you, Frank. Frank, can I ask you to sit up front? We're going to have Q&A in a little bit. Not yet, but in a little bit. Our next speaker. So how many of you have heard of Rasmé Odeh? Yes. So Rasmé's situation and case means a lot to us. And, you know, as we're here linking the struggles of what happens right here on the streets of Chicago to what's happening around the world, the fight against imperialism here and the resistance against it that's growing around the world, almost no case highlights it so well as Rasmea's. Today we don't have Rasmea here, but we are welcoming Hatem Abudaya, the National Coordinator of the Rasmea Defense Committee, to speak on her behalf. Rasmea Odeh is a 67-year-old Palestinian-American community leader who was tortured by the Israeli government in 1969. On November 10th, 2014, in front of supporters in the courtroom, Rasmea was unjustly convicted of one count of unlawful procurement of naturalization and sentenced to 18 months in prison and deportation. The appeals court heard oral arguments on October 14th, and we are currently awaiting the decision in her case. Rasmea's struggle is far from over, and we still need your support to ensure that we win justice. To speak on her behalf today, I'd like to welcome Hatem to the stage.
Yeah.
Damn Frank Chapman. He had to sing at the end of his damn speech. So I have to say first and foremost that Rasmiya really, really wanted to be here today. And I'm sorry that she's not. She's a lot more photogenic than I am. She's a lot more powerful than I am. And her standing and sitting next to Frank Chapman would have been a powerful, powerful thing to see. And I want to also say that I'm very, very lucky because I am somebody who's been in the movement for around 20 years now, but only recently I've been able to say that, you know, my mentors are two of the most important people in Chicago and in the movement around the country, Frank Chapman and Rasmiya Arouda. So I'm gonna offer a little bit of an analysis of Rasmiya's case and why she's under attack. And also, because this is an organizing meeting, and it's not just a meeting in which we come and offer rhetoric and talk to each other. We analyze, of course, we're good at that, and then we're even better at implementing plans and organizing. So there's a lot of lessons to be learned from the Rasmiya defense work, and I think those lessons should be heard here, and people need to know what's next in the case and the support that we need. So there's a couple folks, other folks in the room here that came across the FBI on September 24th, 2010. They came to my home and the homes of five others in Chicago and in Minneapolis, and they raided an office of the Anti-War Committee in Minneapolis as well. On that day, nine people were served subpoenas to a federal grand jury. 14 people, I'm sorry, were served subpoenas to a federal grand jury, and they were investigating what they called material support for terrorist organizations, because a number of us had organized delegations to Palestine and Colombia, and that we had unabashedly and unashamedly said throughout our political careers that international solidarity is not a crime, and that we would support the right to self-determination and the right of resistance of the Palestinian people and the people of Colombia and the people of the Philippines and people all over the world who are fighting against U.S. imperialism and capitalism. And we said that unabashedly and unashamedly, and so we organized educational delegations, Colombia and to Palestine and other places. And so we were raided on that day, and the investigation is still not over. The statute of limitations on that is 8 years. So they have until sometime in 2018 to indict if they want. But they haven't been able to indict because of our defense work. Because the very next day on September 25th, the Committee to Stop FBI Repression was formed as a national organization saying we're fighting back against this repression. In December of that same year, nine more people were subpoenaed to the federal grand jury. At that point, we knew who the target was and what level of work that they were looking at. They were looking at Palestine support and solidarity work specifically, because those nine people all had done Palestine support work in their political careers, and six additional ones were Palestinian from the United States Palestinian Community Network. So at that point, we knew who the target was, and we knew that they were targeting Palestine and support for Palestine and solidarity for Palestine. And at the end of December, when we found out about the additional nine, the 23 of us got together and said, we are resistors, and we are not going to testify to a federal grand jury. We will not go to a grand jury and testify against our friends and our colleagues and our comrades. And all of us resisted that grand jury. And because of that, and because we built a defense committee that was big and broad and had faith organizations and civil liberties organizations and solidarity organizations and labor organizations, we were able to stave off. That's the reason, understand, we staved off all of those indictments that we thought were coming down because we built international solidarity right here in the United States. And I know that a lot of the people in this room were part of doing that. And so we appreciate every minute of work that people put into the community to stop FBI repression. But that made us experts on repression and defense for October 22nd, actually. Today is the anniversary of the day that Osmia was arrested in 2013. So she was arrested that morning, and we got her out immediately that day. She posted bond. We knew immediately that it was related to our case, because one of the main prosecutors on our case, Barry Jonas in Chicago with the U.S. Attorney's Office, was in court on that day. And if it was truly an immigration charge, as they are claiming, then Barry Jonas wouldn't have been anywhere near it. He's the national security person for the U.S. Attorney's Office here. So we knew that Osmia's case was related to ours. We also knew that Osmia's name was listed on search warrants and subpoenas and all of those things that we saw in my home and in the home of Joe Osbaker and Steph Yorick and Mick Kelly, a bunch of us, reunion here today of the people who got raided. And Rasmia's name was listed there, as was the name of the organization of which she and I are our colleagues, and we share an office, the Arab American Action Network. So we knew we had suspicions that it was related to our case, and you know, we know now, or we've assumed now, we've put out the line that says that they weren't able to indict anybody of the 23 of us who were subpoenaed. They had no evidence of material support for terrorist organizations. The only evidence they have is political support, legitimate political support for national liberation struggles. That's what, if we're guilty of anything, that's what we're guilty of. They had nothing, and they still have nothing. And so what they did is they don't declare losses. We know that the federal government has unlimited resources, and so they thought they could go after Rasmi Arouda. And so we first and foremost, and we even filed a motion at one point saying that this was fruit of the poisonous tree. If we believed that their investigation of us was illegal and that they violated our civil rights and our civil liberties, then finding Rasmiya through that investigation was also illegal. And that's what we contended from day one. But with Rasmiya, just to say a couple things specifically, and then we'll talk about the fight. Why did they go after us, and then why did they come after Rasmiya? So those who, you know, didn't know that much about her before this case didn't know that she is considered one of the considered one of the foremost leaders in the Palestine liberation struggle for 50 years. That she had started organizing when she was 15, 16 years old, doing refugee resettlement work because she was a refugee herself. She was pushed off her family's land in 1947. She was also pushed out of her home, and her home was destroyed in 1967 in the two, you know, major wars, the settler colonialist Israeli wars against the Palestinian people. And so she began organizing in when she was 15, 16 years old. And had organized nonstop for refugee resettlement and against Israeli occupation until she was arrested and raped and sexually tortured and forced into a confession in 1970. She spent 10 years in prison, in an Israeli prison. She came out 10 years later in a prisoner swap. And so everybody knew. The State Department knew because her father was a U.S. citizen. The Israelis knew. It's not like this person was a stranger to the movement. It's not like this person was a stranger to the Israelis and the Zionist enemy. Everybody knew the name of Rasmiya Arouda. Everybody knew who she was, and they knew who she was when she came to this country. So for them to claim then, 10 years after she had received citizenship, and 20 years after she had received her permanent residency, that she was here illegally and that she lied to get in here is obviously nothing but a pretext for going after another one of our icons and one of our leaders. Now, the seven of us amongst the 23, the seven Palestinians, are pretty good organizers in our own right, but she's a much bigger fish that they went after. But they went after us and they went after her for the same reasons. The main reason is that Zionism is in crisis, just like U.S. imperialism is in crisis, and Zionism is on its way out in Palestine. The ultra-right, even in Israel, the ultra-right is being isolated. The reason why these mad dog, racist settlers are going after Palestinians in Jerusalem and burning people's homes and attacking young men in the streets and burning young men alive, which they've done, is because they understand that their time is over in Palestine. The settler colonialist project in Palestine is on its way out, because there is no more mirage of a two-state solution. That has been rejected by the majority of the Palestinian people in Palestine and in the diaspora. We know what we've known since 1964, when the PLO was first established, that the only solution for Palestine is a one secular state for all the people that live there, which means a destruction of the concept of Zionism. And we've seen in the Palestinian resistance in 2008 and 2009 in Gaza, and then the resistance victory. And it was a victory, and you can read one of our documents there that talks about why it's a victory. 2014, Palestinian victory against the Israelis, that they don't have an army that cannot be defeated. That we can defeat that army militarily, and we could defeat that concept of Zionism politically and diplomatically and in the court of public opinion, which we have been doing because of the boycott, divestment, sanctions. Even in the United States now, Israel is being seen as the pariah terrorist state that it is. And it's on the run, and the Zionists are going to have to leave and find somewhere else to live. And one thing I was reminded when I saw Jesus come in this morning is that we're here to talk about international solidarity, to rebuild ILPS and rebuild anti-imperialist, anti-war work in this country. And one of the things that I remember vividly, it was either 08 and 09 when President Chavez was still alive, or in 14 when President Maduro was in town. But the Venezuelans kicked the Israelis' asses out of Venezuela. And to this day have not resumed diplomatic relations with Israel because of its crimes against the Palestinian people. That's what we talk about when we talk about international solidarity. So Rasmia was arrested in 2013. She was charged with unlawful procurement of naturalization. They're saying that she lied by saying she was never in prison when she filled out her applications. So there are a number of legal explanations, and we've been to court over and over and over again. We have the best movement lawyers in the world, probably, with the People's Law Office, Michael Deutsch and Jim Fennerty and others in Chicago. And we've had support from lawyers in New York and in the Bay Area and everywhere as well. But she was convicted, as was mentioned earlier. She was convicted of this charge because we were not able to make a case. We were not able to say that Rasmia was imprisoned falsely in Palestine by the Israelis, that she was tortured into a confession, that she does not recognize that was a legitimate arrest or quote-unquote crime, that she had committed no crime. And so for the U.S. government and immigration to then turn around and say she was arrested and she was convicted by a foreign country, and that she did not write that here on her application, and that's why she was convicted. We rejected that portrayal of her and that legal statement from the government. We also reject it because Rasmia is a survivor of torture. She's a survivor of sexual torture. She has documented post-traumatic stress disorder, which means that her experts who are not only nationally renowned, internationally renowned experts in the survivors of torture, have said that she would not have been able to answer that question because of her mental state. So that argument we were not able to make in the in court. And because of that, we appealed and said, we have to be able to say why it is that Osmia answered this question or did not answer that question. And we won that appeal. The appellate court sent it back to the trial judge saying that, yes, the trial judge may have erred. He may have made a mistake in not allowing this evidence, the evidence of the post-traumatic stress disorder. What does it mean now, potentially, when we go back to a hearing on November 29th, and we're going to call for a national day of action on or around November 29th? There's already an action being planned in New York and Minneapolis and Florida and other places in the Bay Area. We want everybody to do national days of action when we're in Detroit, filling that courtroom again like we filled it for 3 years in support of Rasmia. But what happens there, if that judge then decides that we're going to a new trial, then we get to put the torture evidence into a new trial. And we get to put Israel on trial in an American court. It's crimes against the Palestinian people. That's why November 29th is such an important date that everybody should have in their calendars. Again, we will be in Detroit. We're hoping with at least 200 people, and folks around the country will also be protesting in support. And November 29th also, for those who may not know, is the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. That is the day in 1947 in which the United Nations partitioned Palestine, the first illegal international move made against the Palestinian people that led to the colonization and the settler colonial state of Israel. But I want to say now, I want to go into, we've got the analysis of Israel and Zionism, a little bit of one, why they're coming after people like Rasmia and us, of course, because the United States needs to make sure that Israel is not under attack. They have to make sure that Israel continues to play the role that it plays for U.S. imperialism in the Arab world, and that means they go after all of the people who are changing hearts and minds in the United States, whether it's Muslim leaders, Palestinian leaders in our community, or students from SJPs around the country. And I know we have a New York City SJP here at least, right? Yeah. and folks like Rasmia and the Midwest 23. The United States is doing what it does. It is going after the social justice movements, like it devastated the Black Panther Party and the Black Liberation Movement, the Chicano Liberation Movement, the American Indian Movement. All of the social justice movements in our history have come under attack from the feds, and the Palestinians are no different. But when they came after us, we went after the prosecution immediately. Immediately, we said, this is the target. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Detroit and in Chicago, and we organized call-in days and write-in days and challenged. What we did was challenge their independence from Israel. We basically said, you are doing the duty of the Israeli government and perpetuating Israeli repression against Rasmia and Palestinians here in the United States. We did the same for the judge at the time. The first judge, if people remember, was a man named Paul Borman, and we forced him, even though he went after us in one of his rulings, we forced him to recuse himself because we proved that he had relationships with the state of Israel, economic and political relationships with Israel, and he was forced to recuse himself in a massive victory for the movement, not just for the lawyers, for the movement. We didn't back down even when the prosecution filed a motion calling the supporters mobs and hordes. He called us mobs because we had women and men in their 60s and 70s who went to Detroit for every single hearing and for the trial, marching with Palestinian flags. They even wrote in the ruling, these people are carrying Palestinian flags in front of the court. Like that's supposed to be some kind of crime. And even when they called us mobs and hordes and tried to criminalize our activity, we went even after them even more intensely. We got Rasmia released from prison and solitary confinement after her conviction by bombarding the sheriff's office with phone calls and letters and having prominent leaders, faith leaders, and black liberation leaders and others write to the judge. He reversed himself and he finally recognized that Rasmiya does have a community and she's not a flight risk. And we built on a national and even on some level international committee of support. As I said earlier, we built very, very broadly with black liberation, women's rights, union, faith-based civil rights, immigrant rights, and Palestine solidarity support. We never shied away from the fact that this was a political case, but we also did a really great job of connecting it to local issues that we all care about and that the majority of the American people care about. And this is, as I wrap up, an important conclusion to this presentation, which is that Rasmiya's case is a personification of everything that the Palestinian struggle is about. It's about refugees, it's about political prisoners, it's about torture, it's about exile, it's about occupation, it's about political repression, it's about attacks on women's rights and freedoms. All of the main issues in the Palestine national struggle, national liberation struggle, are all personified by that woman right there in the middle there. And so that's why we believe, and ILPS believes, and the Chicago Coalition Against Racism and Political Repression believes, and all of the other partners in the Rasmiya Defense Committee in this room and across the world believe that this is the most important case in U.S. courts today. That a victory for us, a new trial in January, victory in that trial is a victory not only for Rasmiya, but it's a victory for the Palestine National Liberation Movement across the world. Thank you very much.